From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. We're 11 hours away from a partial shutdown of the federal government. The Senate's voting right now on a continuing resolution to fund the government, but it's not expected to pass. We'll have the very latest for you on where things stand. Also, we'll talk about changes in the administration of President Trump, all to come on Air Talk. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Maybe you're getting an early start on the holiday weekend. If so, I hope it's good. Maybe you're getting out of town, headed to the airport, driving out of town to visit family or friends for the holiday and taking a long weekend. We wish you all the best. I'll actually be heading out after today and be off for about a week and a half. And we have some terrific guest hosts who'll be in while I'm away. The show will actually be off on Monday and Tuesday. So Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, no Air Talk. And we're back with guest hosts on December 26th. Coming up, it's Film Week. Our critics reviewing Aquaman, starring Jason Momoa. Vice, which is a satirical biographical treatment of Dick Cheney, starring Christian Bale. And On the Basis of Sex, a biopic, a straightforward one, on Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You just heard on NPR News about the cancerous tissue she had removed from her lungs and that she's recovering in the hospital. She's had a series of health challenges. She's given no indication that she intends to retire from the high court. Clearly, she wants to continue working and presumably would want to have a Democratic president appointing, nominating her successor as well. We have a number of very big political stories to talk about, and joining us to update us on the latest, Bloomberg News national politics reporter Sahil Kapoor. Sahil, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start first with what's happening right now in the Senate, where they're voting on the House bill, which was passed yesterday, includes more than $5 billion in border wall funding. We don't yet have the tally, but this is expected to go down to defeat, correct?
This is expected to go down to defeat. Now, remember, what they're voting on at this moment, as we speak, is a motion to proceed to this. This only needs a simple majority. If this does pass, which, by the way, is not certain, but if this does pass, then they move to a 60-vote threshold on the government funding bill that includes a little over $5 billion for President Trump's wall. That is certain to go down in defeat in the Senate because there are not 60 votes for that. Once that happens, we're going to be very close, just hours away, to a government shutdown. It's going to be up to the Republican leaders in the House and the Senate how to proceed.
And why, you say it's not clear that the procedural vote will clear a simple majority. What would be the strategy behind that?
Well, we don't know how many senators specifically are in attendance. Many of them went home after passing their clean government funding bill without wall money. So we don't quite know if all of them are around. And there seems to be some question about the votes of Republican senators like Jeff Flake and Bob Corker. Are they going to go along with this?
All right. And if they don't pass either the preliminary or the vote on the actual continuing resolution, we're looking at a government shutdown, partial shutdown, in now less than 11 hours. So which departments would that affect?
It would affect about one-fourth of the government, and because keep in mind that the Congress has already funded parts of the government. A lot of spending on things like Social Security checks are under the mandatory slice of the pie that aren't affected by shutdown. So this would be a partial government shutdown. There would be closures of national parks and monuments and museums. There would be hundreds of thousands of government employees who are on furlough and don't work. There would be thousands more who do work, who are considered essential employees on issues like border security, on, you know, ICE agents, border patrol agents, who would work but would not be paid for the duration of the shutdown.
All right. So, yeah, but it could be retroactive whenever it's funded. So ultimately, they would be paid, but a tough time of year to
That's
not
right.
get your check.
Exactly.
All right. Sahil Kapoor joining us from Bloomberg News, national politics editor. Now, President Trump seemingly vacillated with the messages that he gave about how essential it was to him to have $5 billion in border wall funding. What is a potential way out of this now that he's made it very clear? He said he's not going to sign anything that doesn't have that funding, and the Senate doesn't appear it's going to pass anything with that funding.
Right. So the only way out of this is if he can find 60 votes in the Senate for his wall money, which doesn't appear to be in the cards in the least bit, because there are only 51 Republicans. They need 9 Democrats, and they're nowhere near that many who, you know, are willing to support his wall or frankly have any incentive to vote in favor of it. So either he does that, which is highly unlikely, or the president backs down and says, okay, I'm going to keep the government open at existing levels and try to fight for the wall later. Now, the president is very dug in. He's facing a lot of pressure from his right flank. His own base is determined to, you know, see him fight for this border wall, and he seems to be doing that. But as far as the end game, there isn't one for the president at this point.
Sahil, I also wanted to ask you about the health news on Justice Ginsburg. And I know you've been closely following what's going on with the vote in the Senate, but have you had a chance to talk with any people about concerns over the health of the justice?
Well, this is some late breaking news. As you pointed out, she had two cancerous nodules removed from her lungs. These were apparently discovered when she fell and fractured her ribs in November 7th. This is obviously enormously, enormously consequential to the Supreme Court, where she is the leader of the court's liberal wing. She is also a pop culture icon who has achieved the kind of national fame that few Supreme Court justices ever do. She is 85 years old, which is beyond the age that Supreme Court justices on average serve on that court. So if she were to leave the court, it would be enormously consequential for the country. But the Supreme Court statement says that she's resting comfortably. She's expected to remain in the hospital for a few days. And frankly, fracturing her ribs and falling may have saved her life if they discovered it early because of that.
It's ironic that the biopic about her formative years starring Felicity Jones on the basis of sex opens on Christmas Day. And so here you've got a film that's sort of, you know, celebrating the important historic role she serves a woman on the high court and what led her to that at the same time that she's got this significant health challenge. Sahil, thank you so much. Appreciate your being with us and updating us on the latest from D.C.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Sahil Kapoor, politics reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on Air Talk. Also with us, political analyst Sean Walsh, Republican, and Matt Rodriguez, Democrat. Matt, let me start with you on this. First of all, the significance of the health of Justice Ginsburg, not just the fact that, as Sahil just said, she is a cultural icon, yeah, but the potential for the court if she's not able to return to the bench.
Well, hugely impactful. You've got, well, it's actually important on a lot of levels, right? They're going into a new session for the court, so there'll be consequential decisions to come down. You have your second piece, which is if something does happen, and she's had some health issues starting to pile up. She's 85. She had the pancreatic issue, cancerous. Now you're finding these. You know, she fell and broke her ribs, and they said they found it that way. We don't know if that could be the reverse. Typically, you know, maybe she fell or was easily breaking a rib because she's got some other issues there, or that the cancer has spread. They're not going to say that right away. We don't know. But the point is, if she is unable to come back, this is going to make the Kavanaugh hearing look like a Disney movie, because this is going to be this could really put the court on a conservative trajectory, really in perpetuity, at least for the next several decades. It's already kind of leaning that way anyway. So losing a liberal justice, the other liberal justices like Kagan or Sotomayor are much younger. You would think that they're going to be around for a while. So, the news just keeps getting bigger and bigger. I don't know. The Ginsburg thing, we're just going to have to play out over time here.
What the doctors are saying is optimistic.
Sure.
So you accept that at face value, would be good news.
I think
and
you
would
have
point
to.
Toward her return.
I think you have to. But everyone's been watching this. And look, she's an 85. You know, she's 85. So the bottom line is look, maybe she's still there in 5 years and we don't know. But 85 is 85. And there's no question the biggest watch of all the court watch, like of the court observers is on Ginsburg because of her age. And some of the health issues she has had that have been relatively serious and feel like they're starting to pile up a bit.
Sean, your thoughts about the significance of the health challenge for Justice Ginsburg?
I just think it's absolutely tremendous. I think a big part of what changed the dynamics in Congress this time were suburban women, including suburban Republican women. And so having her coming up, having the Roe v. Wade issue potentially arising, will be a huge issue in the next election cycle, both from a presidential perspective. The Republicans also have 25 Senate seats up that they have to defend, similar to what the Democrats had to defend this time out. So I think it will be if you thought there was a lot of spending in the last election cycle, Katie barred the door. I just think this is a rallying cry for women and Democrats to make sure that certain issues they care about are protected at the court level.
Is that Katie Hill or Katie Porter?
Indeed.
Both the way it's going.
Calling all Katie's. Yeah.
We're talking about the two Democratic winners in congressional races here in Southern California who unseated Republicans. Sean, about the partial government shutdown, which is looming here in just a few hours. What do you think of the political consequences of that?
Well, it's going to be interesting. So the president basically told the Senate, I'm okay with your 7-month kick the can down the road temporary funding solution. And then Congress was basically spread to the four winds. The Republicans were mostly out of their offices. They literally had, it's like Sally Lou Who in their offices, just, metal wire against the walls. And miraculously, they all came back and voted for this issue. So I think the president can't do to Republican members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate, what he's done, which is say, I'm okay one day and then switch directions literally 24 hours later when Laura Ingraham and Rush Limbaugh and Meadows and some conservatives start saying, you're turning against us on the really important issue that we care about. So, the one thing I will say is if there's one person who can figure a way out of this, it's Mitch McConnell. He's a bit of a wizard in his Svengali. The last time we had the budget shutdown that dealt with President Obama, he actually invented the sequestration process, which was the mandatory cuts. And he didn't think anybody would actually buy off on it. He never thought Congress would go along with it. And, 7 years later, here we have dealing with sequestration issues. So if anybody can figure it out, it's McConnell, because he's really a brilliant legislative tactician. But, I think we may be in for a shutdown at least throughout the weekend.
The Senate Majority Leader, about 30 minutes ago, addressing the full Senate.
Let's not end this year the way we began it, with another shutdown over the issue of illegal immigration. Remember this back in January? All because the Democrats are unwilling to support common sense measures to address it. Let's advance this legislation, Mr. President. Let's pass it. Let's finish our work for this year. Let's secure our country.
Can we ban the term common sense from American politics? Is there any two-word utterance that is as meaningless now as common sense?
I don't think the Republican Congress could pass it, Larry. But maybe when the Democrats take charge in the new year, maybe
we
Democrats,
have a shot. It's always common sense, gun control, whatever.
Everything's common sense.
Yesterday we heard from the UTL leader, common sense.
It's just so obvious. Isn't it obvious?
Of course, whatever I want is common sense. I think that's two words we could do without. We just heard Mitch McConnell, who is the Senate Majority Leader, calling for the vote, the procedural vote, ahead of the vote on the continuing resolution. We're talking with Matt Rodriguez and Sean Walsh, Democratic and Republican political strategists. Also want to ask you, Sean, you mentioned about the conservative commentators on Fox News elsewhere coming back and hammering the president about this. But fact is, with Democrats taking over the majority of the House, this is his last shot, right, to get billions of dollars for a border wall. So why wouldn't he go to the mat this time?
Well, I don't agree with that, Larry. It's his last chance, perhaps, to get $5 billion for a border wall without DACA attached to it, without a whole host of other immigration reforms that would come with it. So, going into the next session, and we've got a pretty strong number of folks in the Senate side, and he would have to compromise with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. I do think there can be a grand solution on immigration reform that would include funding for a barrier and tamper-proof identification, but with that, it's going to have have to come compromise on a host of other issues. Again, probably some family reunification issues, chain migration issues, and like I said, the DACA issue.
Well, and there's also two ways to look at this, Larry. There's a political and a substantive. So I think a lot of Republicans were actually, I think Mitch McConnell.
Substantive?
Well, let's not get carried away. Well, but I think
You're asking a lot.
I think some Republicans were actually saying, no, it's better to have this fight with Nancy Pelosi for this reason. I don't know if I subscribed it one way or the other, but you basically have a substantive fight, which you might win, but probably won't, with GOP Congress in its waning days? Or do you have a political fight with Nancy Pelosi and make this about, because I think McConnell's advice was have the fight with Nancy Pelosi. The problem is you're having the fight with us. We're the Congress and we're in charge. So it looks like we can't get anything passed. Have the political fight with Pelosi and make it feel like she's obstructing. Now, essentially, that's still a political fight. He may or may not get his wall. But I think some of the Republicans said, let us get to the new Congress and you can have a more, it'll be an easier fight against Pelosi. You'll get it, but it's a better political terrain for you. Instead, you're attacking us. And this has been the problem from the Republican Congress from the beginning. They're incompetent. They can't get anything done. And so they're ending the way they did with Obamacare, if you remember, and the immigration stuff to start with. And so it's been a problem from day one for them substantively. And I think McConnell wanted politically to get this into the next session and be like, let's go after Pelosi, who we feel like we can demonize a little bit more and be on surer footing. So that was, the Republican argument to him until his right flank blew up this week. And now we're in sort of chaos now.
All right. We're talking with Matt Rodriguez, Sean Walsh. Norma writes on the page in regard to my suggestion we ban the phrase common sense when people argue their case. She said, I wish they'd try common decency. That's Norma writing on the Air Talk page. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll continue our conversation with our political analysts and want to hear what they have to say about Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, not just resigning his position, but the letter that he wrote in resignation to President Trump, where he clearly outlines differences with the president and their views of how to relate to the rest of the world. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I know it's a lot of politics, but there's a lot going on, surprisingly, heading into the Christmas holiday weekend. Coming up on Film Week, we get a break, talk about one of the biggest movie release weeks of the year. Three critics in because we have so many movies to review, including Aquaman, starring Jason Momoa, Vice, a satirical take on Dick Cheney, Christian Bale stars with Amy Adams, Sam Rockwell, and Steve Carell, On the Basis of Sex, a biopic on young Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Felicity Jones stars, also Poland's official submission for the Oscar foreign language category, the movie Cold War from Paweł Pawlikowski, the acclaimed director. And Nicole Kidman stars in Destroyer. She plays an LAPD detective in that film from Karan Kusama. Right now, we continue our discussion on politics and the resignation of the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, who wrote a letter in resignation to the president in which he says, one core belief I've always held is that our strength as a nation is inextricably linked to the strength of our unique and comprehensive system of alliances and partnerships. While the U.S. remains the indispensable nation in the free world, we cannot protect our interests or serve that role effectively without maintaining strong alliances and showing respect to those allies. Like you, I have said from the beginning that the armed forces of the United States should not be the policemen of the world. Instead, we must use all tools of American power to provide for the common defense, including providing effective leadership to our alliances. NATO's 29 democracies demonstrated that strength in their commitment to fighting alongside us following the 9/11 attack on America. The Defeat ISIS coalition of 74 nations is further proof. He goes on in building the case for America working with its allies. He makes the point that he is resigning because of disagreement with the president on that issue of working with allies. Says, because you have the right to have a Secretary of Defense whose views are better aligned with yours on these and other subjects, I believe it is right for me to step down from my position. Sean Walsh, your thoughts on not just the resignation, but the way in which he's resigned.
Well, I will tell you, Larry, all this budget issues aside, I think that'll end up kind of sorting itself out in the wash. That's what we've had 20-odd shutdowns since 1976. So, you know, we'll survive this one like we survived the last one in 2013. But what I will tell you is the way that Secretary Mattis resigned and who Secretary Mattis was, particularly for Republicans, he was a rock-solid base foundation person for what they thought was an important stability in the Trump administration, and his resignation and the way he resigned, I think, has opened up a major, major crack in the foundation of Republican support and faith in the president. And I say mainstream Republican support and faith. I think there's activist Republicans that will continue to support President Trump. But this is a major, major political problem for the president. I don't think he saw it coming, and that's a problem. And tie in the fact that not only are you going to have a vacancy at DOD, but you've got a new Justice Department confirmation process that has to happen. You've got one at Interior. You've got one at EPA. So, I mean, the president's going to be running multiple confirmation hearings, which are politically withering at the same time he's trying to do all these other issues. It's a real huge problem. Plus, he'll have likely hearings on the Democratic side in the House looking for more investigations on Russia, more investigations on, you know, Moscow deals, et cetera. So, I mean, the president has just inherited and made a huge mess for himself going into the next congressional cycle.
Sean, is there someone, if not of the stature of Mattis, but someone who at least would calm those concerned about, you know, having someone stabilizing in that position?
So think about this for a minute, Larry. So we've had three very, very impressive military leaders, real patriots that have been involved in the Trump administration. One is General Mattis. The other is General Kelly, who's now stepping away. And then the other was General McMaster on the National Security Advisory Team. And all three of these people dealt with this administration. They didn't like what they saw, and in many respects were either not respected or basically pushed out. So if you are a really strong person who has what it takes to successfully lead the DOD, it's got to be someone with military background and experience, or at least very, very credible in Washington, you know, circles, like a Leon Panetta or like a Gates. So you look at what the president does. He sends out tweets dumping all over his Department of Justice person on, you know, almost on a weekly basis. And you look at a guy who you know, ignores the advice that General Mattis has with regards to what's going to happen in Syria. And my God, the signal that sends to people around the world, you may have Kurds slaughtered, and the Kurds have been basically our army on the ground, saving thousands of American lives by being the combat soldiers on the ground. Any military guy is going to look at this thing or gal and say, man, do I really want a part of this? I'm not so sure they do. And so the patriotic gene that says, yes, I'm going to step in and help my country is going to be buttressed by the president who's gone out and publicly dumped on his cabinet people. It's a real, real problem.
And this follows the long search to find someone for his chief of staff because Seemingly no one wanted to take that.
Yeah, no, it's I really can't say much better than Sean. It's a mess. Incompetence is kind of the buzzword of this administration. It has been from the beginning. You know, Mattis is an interesting figure. What has been sort of, I don't know if it's disheartening is the word, or really remarkable to watch, is almost everyone who has gotten near Trump in some form has been, his reputation has been tarnished and diminished. I think Mattis is one of the few, maybe Nikki Haley, who's leaving the administration with his reputation enhanced. And that has become almost impossible with this president. He's basically either he has trashed everybody, or there've been ethics issues going on, or they just look bad. And I agree with Sean. I don't know who is going to want to take this job. We're at a very pretty critical time. I mean, DOD is always an important role, but you're talking about a rising China, not just economically, but militarily. Russia, obviously, with what they are doing. You have European migration issues that are going on. The Middle East, you have Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Now you're left with, you know, how many legitimately serious people are in this administration? and that's just not the people in the swamp, but like maybe Mike Pompeo, maybe Mulvaney coming over to try to stabilize the actual West Wing itself. But this is another serious guy who just wasn't being listened to. He had recommended someone to be Joint Chiefs of Staff. Trump went the other way. They're pulling out of Syria. You've had a lot of Americans fighting on the ground there with ISIS, and they're gonna cede a lot of this territory while Russia and Iran are playing a role in Syria. So, where this is going to go, I don't know. I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but this sounds a lot like almost like a Steve Bannon, someone is back in the president's ear, because he's sort of going way hard again on immigration. He's now looking at pulling out apart some troops out
Afghanistan.
Of Afghanistan and Syria. This has a very much of a feel of I'm going full on base politics and full on kind of way right wing and his kind of like new whatever conservative type of movement that he'd created. But it feels very Bannon and Stephen Miller like, and it seemed like the adults had tried to wrestle away a normal presidency from him, and we're heading back to where the beginning part of this administration started.
It's interesting to me that, you know, we tend to think of presidential candidates running in a more extreme way, and then when they become president, more moderating. Although it's interesting that in the Obama administration, he arguably moved left, particularly in his second term.
Yeah.
Trump seems to be moving harder back toward the candidate Trump perspective. Sean, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, Larry, you actually hit it spot on, dead center, which is what President Trump is doing is I think he's looking at the next election cycle, and he's going to say, I made all these promises when I ran for the presidency, and I'm delivering on those promises. One of his promises, and he did not have much of a seasoned foreign policy team around him, hence why I think you're having all the problems with Mr. Mueller now, the Island of Misfit Toys, who were basically his national security advisory team when he's running for office. One of the statements he made was, and it was very popular, let's pull the troops out of, the Middle East. We don't want to, spend blood and treasury. Well, all that's fine and well, and we've actually withdrawn many, many troops from Iraq, but having 2,000 advisors that are basically using the Kurds as your ground troop army, and you've knocked ISIS down to a tiny swath of land and only 5,000 fighters, to say I'm going to check the box for a campaign pledge when you didn't really have a good full understanding of what the situation was to start with is just really, really ridiculous. And so, I mean, the one thing about Mattis that I will tell you, he was a factor that went simply beyond just being the Secretary of Defense. Mattis actually scared other countries. And he had respect, but also fear of other countries because A, he was very intellectual, B, he's a military man, and kind of he does what he says he's going to do. And so, you will always find somebody to be a cabinet person. There's always somebody ambitious or, hubris enough that I can take that on. But will you find another guy like Jim Mattis and a person or gal? And at this time and in where we are in this country and where we are on a global, political and military scale, you need a guy like Jim Mattis. And I'm not sure we're going to be able to fill that slot with someone who has that level of respect and fear along the world. It's a problem for Trump's foreign policy, and it's a problem long term for American interests. And people are going to ask themselves.
Trump.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I want to get your take before we break about the Afghanistan drawdown that Trump is talking about with 7,000 of the 14,000 there coming home.
Well, I would argue substantively, there's an awful lot of countries and people who have broken their pick in Afghanistan for a long period of time. I think you can make a more reasonable argument to draw down some of the troops from Afghanistan than you can right now based on what Matt was saying about the Russian interests in Syria, now the Turkish ambitions on what they will probably do if we pull out and probably slaughter a lot of Kurds in the border region of Syria and Turkey and Iraq. So I just think, like I said, it's a real, real problem and a real issue.
Mm-hmm.
And Afghanistan has always fought itself. In some respects, if you can contain Afghanistan, they're going to have their tribal fights and it will go on forever. Syria is a whole different story.
All right. Matt, quick closing word on this.
I think the larger issue, there's obviously the substantive one that Sean is talking about, and there's just the political one, which is it. No matter where Trump lands on this, it doesn't feel like there's any kind of thoughtful process going on here. So this is chaotic, and he's already facing a Republican Congress that lost a ton of seats. They're starting to look at Trump more as a liability, and they're going in with you're talking about losing suburban women. Your other states are going to be on the map in 2020. So I think you have a larger political problem that he's going to start facing, not just with the Democrats, that's obvious, but with Republicans who are like, if this guy's completely toxic for another cycle, he's going to have an even harder time moving forward because he's going to start losing his friends. And that's a concern that he's going to have here, other than his very hard right flank, which he's insisted on playing with. But there's a lot of other senators who are from more moderate states. So he's got a lot of political problems happening. And I think this looks very chaotic to the American people. And that's a bad place to be.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Wish you a very Merry Christmas, good holiday season with your family.
Happy New Year, Larry. Thanks
thank
so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist, Rodriguez Strategies, former senior Obama campaign advisor, and Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst, who's been a staffer with two presidential administrations and two gubernatorial administrations as well. Coming up on Air Talk, a look at what's happening with the refugees seeking asylum in the U.S. who are still on the Mexico side of the border. Back after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. Film Week coming up at 11 o'clock, one of the biggest release weeks of the year. We have three critics in because there were so many films to see this week. And that's coming up for you at 11 o'clock right here on 89.3. We're also going to close out the hour with one of my favorite holiday traditions, a reading of Clement Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas, some of your favorite voices from Christmas past and present. That's coming up in the final few minutes of this hour of Air Talk on KPCC. Well, as you well know, thousands of refugees have made their way from Central America to the border between the U.S. and Mexico. We're seeing many more families arrive than in years past. And yesterday, the Trump administration announced that those seeking asylum at the U.S. border will now be held in Mexico until their cases can be taken up in the United States. We have seen the courts, which handle cases of asylum requests, backed up with very long waits until the cases can be heard. But the question is, does the Trump administration have the authority through this agreement with the Mexican government to hold off on allowing refugees into the U.S. pending disposition of their cases? Or is that something that the administration can't do? Also, what are the pros and cons of that policy on a material basis? With us is Jan C. Ting, Temple University School of Law professor. He was assistant commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service up until 1993. Professor Ting, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Larry. Great to be with you.
First, your sense of the ability of the administration to make this deal and enforce it.
I think there's no question that they have firm legal grounds. Secretary Nielsen, in her statement, cited INA Section 235B2C, which is entitled Treatment of Aliens Arriving from Contiguous Territories, and it provides that in the case of an alien arriving on land from a foreign territory contiguous to the United States, the Attorney General may return the alien to that territory pending a proceeding under Section 240, which is a removal proceeding. So there's clear statutory authority. Congress has authorized the transfer of these individuals back to the contiguous country from which they arrived pending their removal. In the old days, this was a fairly routine thing. And there is nothing in the statute that says, oh, people get to come to the United States and wait however long the proceedings take. There's nothing there. There is this language that says they can be returned to contiguous territory. I don't think there's any doubt that when the issue is finally litigated, probably before the Supreme Court, that court is going to sustain this action.
So there have been some representatives of the refugees who've said the problem is they continue to be preyed on by gang members or people extorting money from the refugees on the Mexican side of the border. So they're still at risk there. Your response to that?
Well, there's no question that we have great sympathy for all the people who are trying to get to the United States. And if we were in their shoes, we might well make the same decision that they make. But the question you're asking is a legal one. Does the administration have the authority to do what it's doing? And I think on that narrow legal question, there is no doubt that the government has the authority. You know, simply saying that the administration action is blatantly illegal does not make it so. I think the administration has looked at this question. They also have INA Section 212F, which the Supreme Court cited in sustaining the travel ban for the broad authority of the political branches to enforce the immigration laws in this manner.
We're talking with Professor Jan Ting of Temple University in Philadelphia. He was Assistant INS Commissioner back 1990 to 1993. Also with us from Human Rights First, Senior Researcher and Policy Analyst Kenji Kazuka. Thank you very much, Mr. Kazuka, for being with us. Your sense of the legal leverage of the Trump administration, whether they have the right to do this.
Thanks so much for having me on the show. With all due respect to Professor Ting, I think that he's missing one crucial point in the INA section that the administration is citing as the authority for this policy, and that's the exception in that policy, in that section of the immigration statute that accepts people who are in expedited removal proceedings, and that would include people who are seeking asylum at a port of entry or have crossed into the United States between the ports of entry from that return to territory, to contiguous territory provision. And that makes sense because Congress created a system to deal with people who fear returning to their countries and who are seeking asylum in the United States. And that's to go through a credible fear screening and then to be placed into removal proceedings after that. And the Congress also created a provision called the Safe Third Country provision. And that's an agreement that can be made between the U.S. and a third country, like we have with Canada, to return certain asylum seekers who have passed through that third country, because that agreement finds that the third country is a safe place for asylum seekers, that there's an asylum process in that country, and that the two countries have made an agreement to return asylum seekers mutually. And that's not what the administration has done here. Here, the administration has taken a unilateral action. And by the way, the Mexican immigration authorities said yesterday that they don't have the legal or operational capacity to take people back who are not nationals of Mexico. So there's a lot of questions remaining about the legality of this program and whether, in fact, it can work in operation.
Mr. Kazuka, what about the ability of the refugees to get legal counsel while in Mexico? Will attorneys from the U.S. who provide counsel to individuals seeking asylum status, will they be able to go to Mexico, meet with individuals there?
That's a major concern for our organization. We also represent people who are seeking asylum in the U.S., and we do that through a pro bono model where we work with attorneys at law firms in New York, in L.A., in D.C., to pair them with people who are seeking asylum in the immigration courts and in the asylum office. And it's a major concern about how we will be able to organize representation for people in Mexico. When attorneys are in U.S. cities, it's difficult to imagine that enough attorneys will be willing to travel to Mexico to meet with clients in order to represent them. And we know that representation is critical for asylum seekers to win their cases. The statistics tell us that about only 1 in 10 asylum seekers will win their case if they're unrepresented, but about 1 in 2 will win if they are represented. So this move by the administration is going to have a huge effect on the percentage of people who are able to win their claims because they're likely to go unrepresented.
Professor Ting, let's sort of step back a moment to look at the crisis with the refugees that's going on right now and the difficulty the U.S. has in providing custody arrangements for those who have come into the United States, the dealing with family members and with children, which has been so fraught. How does this, in a sense, resolve that, if it does, from a humanitarian standpoint, by having individuals kept in Mexico?
Well, again, you're dealing with a legal question. I would just point out one thing, and that is the flood of minors and families to our border began in 2012 with President Obama's announcement of DACA. It's not a coincidence that DACA resulted, I think, in this tremendous flow of young people. In the past, as we all know, the custom was for people to support their families by coming to the United States, making money, and sending money home. But the word got out, and it turned out to be correct, that if you send for your kids, they'll get through. If you bring your kids, you're more likely to get through. And that is what has created this huge problem at the border. The government has always had the legal authority, this contiguous territory provision that I referred to. And the exception that Kenji cites is not an exception. It is expedited removal as a way of removing people expeditiously, and it is at the discretion of the immigration officers whether to place people in expedited removal or not. The normal rule is this contiguous territory rule that I cited, which authorizes the return of aliens to contiguous territory. That is the answer to the legal question. I mean, we can have great sympathy for people, but the refugee law provisions do not apply to everyone who's had a hardship in life. The refugee provisions, both internationally and in our statute, are very narrowly drawn, and they were narrowly drawn deliberately. So people who are crime victims, people who are victims of climate change or natural disaster, hurricanes or earthquakes, you don't meet the international definition of refugee. You're not entitled to asylum in the United States.
Professor, real quickly, let me ask you, do you think that if this holds and that refugees are kept in Mexico pending their hearings, that that will have a deterrent effect on refugees coming from Central America to the U.S.?
Well, I think we live in the age of communications. Everyone knows what's going on everywhere, and the word will spread. You know, conditions that people are living in at the border are known things now. So everybody knows everything.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think everything affects everything else.
Professor Jan Ting of Temple University, Kenji Kazuka of Human Rights First, do you think this will have a deterrent effect on people coming from Central America?
Well, just to be clear, there aren't just people from Central America who are seeking asylum who are stuck in Mexico at the moment. There are asylum seekers from all over the world. So when I was in Tijuana a few weeks ago, we met with a group of more than 20 asylum seekers from Cameroon who are fleeing the conflict there, who have been targeted, who've been arrested, who've been tortured. And so this policy isn't going to just affect people from Central America, it's going to affect the many, many hundreds and thousands of asylum seekers who cross through Mexico hoping to request protection in the U.S. And I don't think that this policy, like many of the others that have been attempted over the years, family detention, family separation, will reduce the number of asylum seekers, because people who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing threats to their lives, aren't going to be deterred by the fact that it may be a little bit more difficult than it was previously to request asylum in the U.S. If they have protection needs, they're going to leave their countries, and that's the situation that we're dealing with today.
Even though this is a longstanding problem in those countries, and the numbers have surged in recent months. So, I mean, there does seem to be an ebb and flow.
Yeah, there's absolutely an ebb and flow, and I think part of that's been related to spikes in violence in countries in Central America.
All right.
We see, you know, many more Nicaraguans coming of late, and that's because of the situation there.
Okay. I want to thank you both for being with us. Kenji Kazuka of Human Rights First, who is senior researcher and policy analyst, and Temple University law professor Jan C. Ting. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in a minute. Film Week is coming up, just a few minutes. Huge week for movies. We have three critics in. You'll hear their reviews. But since we're off Monday for Christmas Eve, wanted to provide our annual holiday tradition today. A reading of Clement Moore's A Visit from St. Nicholas by some of your favorite voices from Christmas past and present, our holiday gift to all of you from us here at KPCC. "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there.
The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads, and Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap.
When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from the bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash.
The moon on the breast of the new-fallen snow gave the luster of midday to objects below, when what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer.
With a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles, his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all!
As dry leaves before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too.
And then in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound.
He was dressed all in fur, from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack.
His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry! His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow.
The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly.
He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him, in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread.
He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work, and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk, and laying his finger aside of his nose, and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose.
He sprung to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim, ere he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
I'm Larry Mantle.
I'm John Horn.
I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Simon Helberg.
I'm John Delancey.
I'm Steve Julian.
I'm Rachel Bloom.
I'm Joshua Johnson.
I'm Sylvia Poggioli.
I'm Ted Lange.
I'm Nick Roman.
I'm Kathleen Turner.
And I'm Huell Hauser.
KPCC's All-Star Night Before Christmas was produced by John Raby and the late Steve Julian. I want to take this opportunity to thank our terrific AirTalk team, as this is my final AirTalk hosting of this year. I'll be back with you in 2019 after taking several days of vacation. And I feel so honored to work with such a terrific group of dedicated people, headed by our senior producer, Fiona Ng, our producers, Matt D'Angelantonio, Natalie Chudnovsky, Carol Galli. This week, Jacqueline Kim was with us, and our terrific news apprentices, Itzi Quintanilla and Matt Bynum. Ethan Service, our engineer, and Tui Mao has been with us the past couple days as Ethan's been under the weather. I appreciate you so much and all the ways you support AirTalk on KPCC. We're off Monday, Christmas Eve, Tuesday, Christmas Day, and guest hosts for you starting Wednesday of next week. Film Week's next. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us on what is a very big week in movies, the pre-Christmas as well as Christmas Day releases. We have so many of them to talk about, including Aquaman on the Basis of Sex, a biopic about the formative years of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Cold War, which is Poland's official foreign language Oscar submission for the year, Bumblebee, a sci-fi action adventure with Hailee Steinfeld, and much more. But we begin with Vice, a satirical biographical drama written and directed by Adam McKay. It stars Christian Bale as former Vice President Dick Cheney, who quietly rose from Washington bureaucrat to VP under President George W. Bush. It co-stars Amy Adams, Sam Rockwell, and Steve Carell.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. People always said that.
Yeah, yeah. Very different. Very different from your father in that regard. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military, energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
You get a sense of the tone of the film Vice. Joining us this week are film critics Tim Cockshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegots.com, Leo Lowenstein, and Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian, host of the podcast The Canon and Unspooled. Amy, start us out on Vice, please.
Yeah, well, people know writer-director Adam McKay as being the guy who made amazing comedies, and we're talking Step Brothers and Anchorman, and has been moving into political films. He made The Big Short a few years ago. He's trying to see if he can make the things that are traumatizing and horrible today funny, which, you know, depending on how much you feel like laughing at watching Dick Cheney take over and plunge us into the war and terror, sort of a mixed bag. I mean, what I thought was interesting about this take on Dick Cheney, it opens up with him getting a DUI, you know, kind of allusions in a way to the man he'll be vice president for later on, not being so different from him, being kind of a screw up. And through sheer force of will of Lynn Cheney saying, I will dump you if you don't become a man who seizes power, becoming a man who seizes power in a way that's very gray and bureaucratic. What I think is fun about the movie is Cheney himself, you know, and you know that this Christian Bale gained 40 pounds to play this role, is so monotonous that there's even a scene where he says, I can say the wackiest stuff, but if I say it in this voice, you're all going to nod like I'm really reasonable. So you have that balancing a film that's absolutely insane with like MTV montages and madness and cougars screaming at the camera.
Mm. Kind of like The Big Short, where he did so many asides and the humorous asides in that film.
Exactly. I think there might even be more. What do you guys think?
No, well, I don't, you know, biopics can be tricky because sometimes they can slip into history. And people start to mistake the stuff in a biopic for things that actually happened in history. I've seen this happen. I've been teaching film for a long time, and I have students quote things back at me that came out of movies. So this is what we have to be careful about here. Dick Cheney's public life is well known, how he came up. His personal and private life, not so much. This movie makes up a lot of stuff about that. The one thing the movie does do that I appreciate, Adam does do, is he says, I'm going to make up a lot of stuff. And they just say it in the movie. We don't really know anything about this, but we think it happened something like this. And it's entertaining. It's interesting. But you have to remember, this is not actually history. It really isn't. Tim, it sounds like you object on the basis of the historical accuracy question. Getting that right? Well, yeah, it's not so much an objection. The movie is really entertaining. I actually very much enjoyed it. But even now, I'm starting to hear people quote things at me about Dick Cheney.
There are
whole cloth out of this movie.
Would it have been better to have a fictional character?
I think it's almost always better. Think about the movie W. Go back to all of Oliver Stone's movies, the great Nixon movie. We even had the tapes. So, you know, but there are all kinds of things that live in the zeitgeist today as fact about Nixon, about JFK, about George W. Bush, which are just made up stuff.
Yeah,
that's
well, Oliver Stone's a pretty influential,
yeah,
quote, historian.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what do you think, Leo?
Look, I hear you, Tim. I actually, history is a tapestry, and it's a tapestry of different media and experiences and times. And I think Adam McKay, better than any filmmaker that I can think of right now, does a terrific job of rendering the opaque
comprehensible. Like The Big Short, for example, you know, took a subject that was so dense and so complex and made it funny and light and one of the best movies of the year. So in this case, yes, it's MTV meets meets the War on Terror. It's the fancy graphics and dazzling performances and credits in the middle of the movie. I mean, it's kind of beyond anything that you'll see in any movie right now, and yet it's the best of all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I had a hard time laughing at the movie, but I will say what I found the most chilling was I didn't really realize how far back the history goes with people like Cheney and Rumsfeld. You know, you watch them together when they're young. When Cheney is so new to politics, he decides to be a Republican basically as a coin flip. He's like, why not? You're taking Democrat, I'll take Republican. And just committing
that
to
one
side. That
sounds made up, though.
This is what I mean.
I wouldn't take that as literally.
But I'm using that more as an example of he's so young in this film. But to realize that these people who changed the world in the early 2000s have known each other for decades. Going back like that, where it feels almost like a high school movie.
Oh, yeah, and been a part of the American.
That scares me to live in a thing where the world is so small.
To the accuracy question, though, I just wanted to say that I thought it did a stunning job of recreating the look, the feel, and the sound of some of these people. I mean, Steve Carell is Rumsfeld. There are moments when you actually think you're looking at Don Rumsfeld, the way he's lit and the makeup, I mean, and his delivery. Yeah.
What about Tyler Perry
as
Colin Powell?
I mean, it was an interesting choice, you know, but I thought he did a good job. What do you think? No?
Tyler Perry is always Tyler Perry.
Right, he's Tyler
Perry.
Make
him not make Tyler Perry Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
We're talking about Vice, a satirical biopic about Dick Cheney. Christian Bale stars with Amy Adams, Sam Rockwell, and Steve Carell. Adam McKay, the writer-director. It's rated R and opens wide on Christmas Day. Aquaman, now open in theaters, starring Jason Momoa, along with Amber Heard, Patrick Wilson, and Nicole Kidman. James Wan is the director. Will Beale, David Leslie, Johnson McGoldrick, the co-screenwriters. Tim.
Whoa. Man, this is positively operatic, this movie. It is big and out of control. And really, really bad. Really bad. Except for Jason Momoa. It's as if he just said, you know what, guys, give me the trident. I'll do whatever you want me to do. And he absolutely just does anything they call upon him to do in this gigantic CGI world. The storyline comes straight out of Game of Thrones with just a dash of Black Panther. There is this world of Atlantis under the sea divided up into all these little kingdoms. Patrick Wilson, who's in the Watchmen movies, which is also a Zack Snyder property. This is directed by James Wan, but it's a Zack Snyder movie. And that's the thing, folks. You're looking at this movie and you're thinking, this is James Wan. No, Zack Snyder movie. It looks like a Zack Snyder movie. It sounds like a Zack Snyder movie. It moves like a Zack Snyder movie. Zack Snyder just has completely ruined the DC universe for me. His take on DC has just been all wrong. He tries to change it here by making it way funnier than you know, like Justice League or something like that, which is why Momoa is just having a good old time. But this movie is just dumb, and then you know what? It gets dumb.
What do you think, Lael?
Wow. I thought the first 20 minutes were kind of promising. I thought, okay, I like Jason Momoa. I like the backstory. Nicole Kidman is introduced as his mother from the sea, Atalanta. And it's kind of got me hooked, right? I'm curious to see how Momoa does with it. He's big, he's beefy, and he certainly looks the part. It pretty soon turns into something that felt talky, heavy, kind of like a beached, bloated whale on the shore.
Keeping it just, with the theme.
Well, it is an aquatic film.
Right. It couldn't keep itself afloat, if you will, and which was too bad because there's enough material there, and Aquaman is enough of a fun character that he doesn't, you know, he's been relegated to being a joke on Entourage for so long where they were going to make an Aquaman movie. That was the whole plot there, that it deserves something, I think, better than a movie that itself becomes a joke.
Amy.
I mean, I think the dumb parts of the movie are the best parts of the movie.
Oh.
I wish it had leaned into being more dumb.
Okay.
There are a lot of freeze frames in here that look like they should be on a heavy metal album cover from the 70s. There's, you know, Nicole Kidman wearing a lobster claw as a glove. There's an octopus playing drums.
Can we talk about Amber Heard's eyelashes, though? Like, what
and
was
that? Hair.
Oh, and that hair. God.
And they're doing an odd thing with some CGI. It's been done before. So when we first meet Nicole Kidman in this movie, in like 1980, whatever it is, they've seen her and the guy that's playing her eventual husband, and they've CGI'd about 20 years off of them. And you're sitting there watching this movie. I'm like, why does Nicole Kidman look like she's 26 years old? Well, but you know what? They're getting good with that.
No, I had to interview Nicole Kidman this week, and she still looks 26
years old. But
no CGI needed.
A contrast to what she's doing in Destroyer, which is what we're going to talk about later. So anyway, yeah.
So just not dumb enough, I guess.
Maybe so.
Right. I wish it was more dumb. Give me more dumb. Give me more of every time Jason Momoa is spinning around, we hear this little trill of electric guitar. Just lean into that.
He's fantastic. And he does
lean into it,
those
I thought.
Little Maori chants and dances and stuff. Oh, that stuff is really intense.
Aquaman, open now in theaters in wide release. James Wan, the director, rated PG-13. On the Basis of Sex, a biographical drama about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's formative years, Mimi Leader directs a screenplay written by Daniel Stipelman, who, by the way, is the nephew of Justice Ginsburg's late husband, Martin. Felicity Jones stars as the young Ginsburg. Armie Hammer, Justin Theroux, Kathy Bates, and Sam Waterston are in the cast as well.
Why shouldn't men be nurses? And if women want to fight fires...
What about pilots?
Yeah, again, if women choose to take on these
judges?
Roles... Judges? Why not?
CEOs, generals? What about garbage men? You want to be a garbage man?
And if men want to be teachers or raise children, percentages aren't the point. People
Wrong.
Should be able to Wrong. Pursue
Wrong.
Their passion.
You're screwing it up, Ruth.
Have you read the appendix attached
You're making
to their
the wrong
brief?
Case.
These are laws... written by men who think we are privileged to be excused from men's obligations, but it is not a privilege, it is a cage, and these laws are the bars.
Well, Lael?
So that comes from a scene where she is practicing to take her first case before the 10th Circuit Court in Colorado. This is a big case, the sexual discrimination case that she's planning to argue, and this is a really pivotal moment in the film. And you can see that she has, for her entire life, taught herself to sublimate emotion at the in favor of reason, and that's a lesson that she learned from her mother. I thought this film did a really persuasive and compelling job of just painting a portrait of a woman who truly was a pathbreaker. There's also, you should take a look at the documentary RBG, which is the sort of unvarnished kind of...
It's a documentary hit of the year.
Yeah, exactly. One of them for sure. But I thought this challenge after challenge, from being one of the first class of women admitted to Harvard Law to being turned down for jobs despite having been first in her class, to having to take care of her husband when he was ailing, the stuff that she had to balance, this woman was just and is phenomenal.
Well,
yes.
Of course, we have the word of her being hospitalized as we speak
today,
right now,
yeah.
for lung cancer and the removal of cancerous nodules. I'm interested in what you all – that dialogue we just heard didn't sound real to me. But
right.
I wonder, in the context of the film, does it work better than that, Amy?
Well, you know, I kept wondering, you know, having seen this and RBG, they almost feel like they're about two different women to me. You know, the arc of the plot is the same, and particularly the devotion to her relationship with her husband, who is really lovely here, played by Armie Hammer. But the Ruth Bader Ginsburg that we see in RBG, she was a woman who the film made a real point about how she ruled with soft power and sort of charm and winning people over to her side. And this Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe because she's younger here, she's not wiser and on the bench, sort of charges ahead and like gets mad at people. And they literally tell her in the movie to smile more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so... they're both interesting stories about power. I don't know how much – I don't know which one to believe in a way. But.
Well, it may be a composite of both. And the fact that this is co-written by her or written by her nephew, it's going to be a positive portrait. But she merits
Tim.
It.
And there we have that biopic thing. Again, it pops up here too. And even for a character that I ostensibly like, you know, so Dick Cheney, not so much her, I do like. What I like most about this movie is the love story. It's an absolutely beautiful love story. And I think that that's true in this movie. That scene works in the movie. That scene works in the movie because Justin Theroux is over there being a real jerk.
It reminded me of the scene in Ray where Ray Charles goes into the record company and says sort of all this stuff that sort of gives you what happened over a long period of time in a very, you know, condensed. So it doesn't feel real, even though the issue is real, as the issue that she described is a real one.
And the case
but the
is
moment
real,
doesn't. Yeah, the moment. We'll continue with more on Film Week in a minute. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking with our critics about On the Basis of Sex, a biopic about the early years of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Mimi Leder directing the film. By the way, John Horn of The Frame interviewed Leder about making the movie. You can find that interview by linking from our Film Week page, kpecc.org. On the Basis of Sex, rated PG-13, it opens Christmas Day at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West Los Angeles. Joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, Leo Lowenstein, and Tim Cogshell. Next up is Bumblebee, a sci-fi action adventure from the world of Transformers. Travis Knight directs a Christina Hodson screenplay. Haley Steinfeld stars as 18-year-old Charlie Watson, who discovers the yellow VW Beetle she got as a birthday gift is far more than a car.
Look, people can be terrible about things they don't understand. If they find you, they'll probably lock you up in a lab somewhere. It'll be bad. Trust me. The only person you can show yourself around is me. Okay?
Tim, what'd you think of Bumblebee?
Well, you know, it was energetic and a lot of fun in a whole bunch of ways. The thing that I liked about it is that this is also a love story. This is a love story. The narrative is almost exactly the same as that original Transporter movie with Shia LaBeouf. He stumbles across this car, they become friends, blah, 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 the whole thing, right? That storyline with the boy. Here we have Haley, though, a young woman. This is written by a woman, too. And that's what she did with this. She took it and made it softer and sweeter and more of a love story. She stumbles across this car in 1985. Bumblebee has been cast out from Cybertron? Is it Cybertron where they are? The home world of the transport. I used to watch that cartoon. I will admit, way after I was supposed to be watching cartoons. I was like 27, and I was dead
serious.
Yeah,
but you were a teacher. You had to be cool with your students, right?
And I just love this stuff. I can't help it. I think this is just a funny, fun action-adventure movie. Haley is fantastic in it. I just love just all that stuff. I had a good time. I'm sorry. I dug Bumblebee.
Amy?
Yeah, I mean, Haley is one of our really great, great, great young actresses right now, although every time she cuddles up on Bumblebee, I kept thinking, he must be cold and there must be grease everywhere. That does not look nearly as cozy as the film wants it to be. I mean, if we're talking about accuracy and representations of people, what was cracking me up about Bumblebee is this is set in 1987, and this is like some mythological, insane 1987 where people are still playing Pong for some reason, and yet there's hair metal that I thought came out in the early 90s. It is like if you went to a theme restaurant in 1987, where you're like, no, this is not actually at all what it was like. So I was just cracking up at that most of the time. I mean, I didn't adore this movie so much. I thought John Cena, when he shows up as a government agent who's very suspicious about these robots showing up on Earth, I thought he had some of the best lines, because the first Transformers he meets are the Decepticons, who make a deal. They're like, we're your friends. And he goes into a meeting with all of the government representatives, and he says, should we trust them? Their name is the Decepticons.
That's the funniest thing.
So that absolutely won me over. But it is hard. There's a little bit of a problem of suspense here, because they're trying to avoid the bad robots coming to Earth and starting a fight. And this is 1987. We know Shia LaBeouf's going to be going through this. So there's a bit of, okay, you know, it's like there is no threat here, really. There is no victory here, really. But it's adorable, and I like hair metal.
Bumblebee, a sci-fi action-adventure film from the Transformers universe, starring Haley Steinfeld. Travis Knight directed, Christina Hodson wrote it. It's rated PG-13, open now in wide release. Poland's official submission for the 2018 Foreign Language Oscar is Cold War. It's directed by the acclaimed Paweł Pawlikowski, who co-wrote the screenplay. Joanna Kulik is the star of the film. Leo, what'd you think of Cold War?
This is just a beautiful film. It's it's so poignant and not for the faint of heart in a sense. So Pavlovsky is a very accomplished filmmaker. He did a film called Ida a couple of years ago that was a tremendous story about a nun with a dark secret.
Some people insist on calling that Ida.
Ida, right. This is a love story about two people who can't be together and can't be apart. Mm. There's Victor, the musician, and Zula, the singer, who is brought into the Polish folk singing tradition, and then very soon that gives way to different kind of music, where propaganda is the music of the day. And these two people are sort of fighting against the politics that conspire to keep them apart, and end up in different countries because they can't simply be together, and it just tears you apart. It's beautifully shot in black and white, elliptically presented with different vignettes that just transport you over the 15 years of their love story. It's just a heartbreaker.
And what did you think of it, Tim? Cold War.
It takes place over the 50s, over the course of the 50s, of course, doing this period.
Soviet.
1949 to 65.
And we spent some time on both sides of the wall, including a period in Paris during that jazz scene in the 50s. This guy plays the piano, amazing piano, just beautiful, beautiful. This is a story. It's a crazy love story, but it's a story about crazy love. These people are crazy in love, and it's that kind of crazy love that you know is just, you know, they can't, but they can't. And that's what's going on in this movie, and it tugs at you so. You can see them just screwing this thing up, but it's so beautiful. It's so beautiful.
Yeah. What did you think of it, Amy?
Well, and this movie is also incredibly sexy. It's nice to see a movie that is just about passion, like actual erotic passion between these two people who are just nuts about each other, you know? It's not like an austere, nice little love. I mean, this is like a romantic, dirty, wonderful love. It's
and it's
crazy.
Not just the carnal relationship between the two of them, and the music is also incredibly sexy. There's an incredible score.
Exactly. They're so drawn together. I mean, I thought Joanna Kulig in this is really spectacular because she enters as a young girl with braids in her hair who is not the best singer, but through sheer force of charm, kind of muscles herself into the singing group. And then, you know, he takes her to Paris. She does not fit in perfectly in Paris. She does not fit in perfectly in a lot of places.
They make a record. That moment that you're talking about when he first meets her, because you're auditioning all of these people to be in these folk groups, and he's sitting there and he's watching her. And you absolutely buy that moment. We talk about love at first sight.
Yeah.
I believed that was love at first sight. Absolutely. He saw her and he was done for the rest of his life.
So we're 3 for 3 on Balakovsky's new film. Paweł Balakovsky directs Cold War, Poland's official Oscar submission. Joanna Kulig and Tomasz Kot are the co-stars of the film. And it's open right now at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles, rated R. Destroyer, a mystery film starring Nicole Kidman as an LAPD detective, Toby Cabell, Tatiana Maslany in the cast as well. Karin Kusama is the director, and the screenwriters Phil Hay and Matt Manfredi. Amy, what'd you think of Destroyer?
Yeah, this is a film that's been very huge on my radar ever since I heard it was happening. You know, Karin Kusama, as a quick catch-up, she burst into the scene with Girl Fight. She was the first director to ever win Best Jury Grand Jury Prize and Best Director at Sundance. First person ever.
That was back in 2000.
Yeah, then she went through the Studio Machine with Aeon Flux, with Jennifer's Body. Now she's been coming back to Indies with The Invitation last year, and now Destroyer, which has Nicole Kidman in it. And this is a movie that, when you describe the plot, it sounds like a cop, a rogue cop, trying to get justice for a crime that went wrong 16 years ago. But the way that Karin puts a spin on it is it's really about a woman who has made a ton of mistakes, cannot deal with her own mistakes, and there's this guilt that weighs on her throughout the whole film. She's a woman who, you know, is destroying her own life very much. I thought this film had a real heaviness to it, you know? You see Nicole Kidman, you see quote-unquote Nicole Kidman, she looks very unrecognizable in the film. You see her do things that, like, in another kind of 48 Hours movie would be really funny. You know, she's like, I don't know your kids' names, blah, 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 blah. But Karin makes everything have this tragedy to it. And the ironic thing about this film is the one scene where anything nice happens for Nicole Kidman, I burst into tears because it's a movie where it just where this character never gets treated nicely.
Yeah, and then we come to understand why. She looks two different ways in the movie. The movie exists in two different periods. When we see her working this case as a cop later in her career, she looks absolutely awful. The makeup is extraordinary. She's skinny and just wretched.
Worn down.
And then every now and again we cut back to 16 years ago, and there's Nicole Kidman, this beautiful young cop on this undercover assignment, and all of these things swirl toward each other and come crashing into each other at the end of this movie. And you're right, there's a heaviness to it, but every moment of it meant to be heavy. Karen, she's just fantastic. She's she went against the norm. She made it and really made it. She works all the time. Works on television. If you look her up,
I see her name in the credits a lot as director.
Yeah, you're watching her work all the time. So it is excellent that she's getting to do something like this.
Destroyer, the film we're talking about, starring Nicole Kidman, Karin Kusama, the director, Phil Hay, Matt Manfredi are the screenwriters. It's rated R, and it opens on Christmas Eve, Monday, at the ArcLight in Hollywood. Next, the drama Welcome to Marwen from director Robert Zemeckis, who co-wrote the screenplay with Caroline Thompson. It's the story of Mark Hogenkamp, actual living person played by Steve Carell, who, after being the victim of a brutal attack, finds his own therapy in creating a 1/6 scale model of a World War II era Belgian town and inhabits it with doll versions of women he admires in real life.
We got your back, Hoagie. We always have your back. We're here for you.
It hurts, Jules. It's so painful.
I know. But you have to love the pain, Hoagie. Like the wise man said, our pain is our rocket fuel. It reminds us of our strength.
Welcome to Marwen, director Robert Zemeckis. Tim?
Marwen Call is the name of the documentary on which this is based, 2010 documentary that I happened to be on the show for when it was out. And then I go and see this film, and the only thing I can really say is see the documentary.
Okay.
This is not working. One reason it's not working is because Robert Zemeckis insists on continuing to work in this sort of uncanny valley with this sort of very particular animation.
Motion capture stuff.
And it's still creepy. It's just still creepy, and it takes you out of the movie. So I don't know. That's a technical thing that never allowed me to get anywhere near this. But also having seen that doc and understanding this, what was actually going on in this guy's story, this doesn't even come close.
What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, I didn't find it creepy. Maybe I'm just creepy. I liked it as sort of like a distancing act. Like, here are the puppets that help you watch a man deal with his trauma, where the hair's really stiff and pokes out in giant ponytails. To me, it was creepier. I got very nervous that this is a film about a odd duck, a man who is really strange in a lot of ways, who is rescued by a miraculous, lovely neighbor played by Leslie Mann, who moves in next door, is very sweet, the sort of neighbor who buys him presents all the time, even though they seem to have known each other for like a week. And I got very nervous this was going to be that film. And to me, that's creepier than anything, where she was going to rescue him. But the one thing that Zemeckis does that I thought was sort of smart is, in the fantasy world, Carell has this wonderful doll who he makes look like her and talk like her, make him a romantic hero. But in real life, the film at least stays grounded in that. This woman is not going to have to save his life. She doesn't have to.
Mm.
Yeah, Janelle Monáe, terrific actor. How does she have much to do in this film?
Yeah, she's missing the legs, but she's most interesting in the context of that little doll sort of running around. And you know, and that stuff, that it's that uncanny valley, you know, that they talk about, where you're looking at those things and they look almost human.
But there's something missing. Welcome to Marwen is the film, and our John Horn interviewed Steve Carell on the frame about his starring role in Welcome to Marwen. That interview can be found on our Film Week page, kpecc.org. Welcome to Marwen is rated PG-13. The film is open in wide release. Many more movies to talk about. It's that kind of a really big week with our critics, the creepy Amy Nicholson, Leo Lowenstein, and Tim Cox. Joining us on Film Week, we'll find out about Kenneth Branagh's All Is True and Second Act, that to come. Film Week, I'm Larry Mantle with our critics Leah Lowenstein, Tim Cogshell, and Amy Nicholson. One film that's opening on Christmas Day, we can't tell you about because it wasn't screened for critics. It's Holmes and Watson, an adventure comedy based on Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, those characters. The stars Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly. Eytan Cohen is the writer-director. He's not one of the Cohen brothers. The film opens Christmas Day. It's rated PG-13, but again, our critics not able to review it. But Tim saw All Is True, a British film directed by Kenneth Branagh, Ben Elton, the screenwriter. Branagh stars with Ian McKellen, Judi Dench, Catherine Wilder. This is quite the benighted cast, Tim.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Thoroughly enjoyed this film. There's only one thing I don't like about it, and it's ridiculously petty. But Kenneth Branagh, who's playing Shakespeare in the film and directing, is wearing this nose to make his nose look like Shakespeare's nose. It's just a terrible, terrible mistake. Lose the nose, and because it was absolutely distracting. Now, this is about this is a movie that tells you all kinds of things that maybe you didn't know about Shakespeare. I did not realize that after the globe burnt in 1613, he never wrote another play. I did not realize that he had a son who was the twin of one of his daughters. I knew he had two daughters, but I did not know that.
Now, are you sure this is true, or is this like
this
the...
This is I know the biopic thing, right? But I went and looked it up, which was... I did not know about some of the absolutely scandalous things that happened, that had happened in his young family. So we work our way through all of that as he goes home to Stratford-upon-Avon to live with his wife, who was much older than him, Judi Dench. And what we get are these wonderful scenes played out, almost like stage plays, like Shakespearean stage plays, Judy and Kenneth there, the lighting, all of that, and he just lets it play. Doesn't cut very often. And Judi Dench just eats up the scenery. It's almost as if Shakespeare had written this movie. So Ben, who wrote this movie, he's very aware of the fact that the content here has to be almost Shakespearean in a particular kind of way. So that petty thing about Kenneth Branagh's nose, I'm sorry, that bugged me. But this movie is really, really good.
All Is True, the film from director Kenneth Branagh, who stars. Ben Elton wrote it, PG-13, the rating, and it's open now at Lemley's Monica Film Center in Santa Monica. Second Act stars Jennifer Lopez as a woman struggling with frustrations over unfulfilled dreams. Peter Siegel is the director. It's written by Justin Zakim and Elaine Goldsmith-Thomas. It's rated PG-13. Amy, what'd you think of Second Act?
Yes. Second Act is a sort of film that Jennifer Lopez can do in her sleep because she's just so good at them. This is Jennifer Lopez tapping into her Jenny from the Block persona, but then also getting a chance to put on the stilettos and be like, I'm a powerful woman. This is basically a nod to Ripping Girl, a nod to Working Girl set in the present. You know, Working Girl having its anniversary actually this year, which is great, where Jennifer Lopez plays a woman who works at as an assistant manager at a grocery store. She's a terrific assistant manager at a grocery store. It's a magical fantasyland grocery store where all of her friends also work. So they have a great time. And then when she's passed over for the big promotion again, her friend's son, who's like a computer hacker, gets her this beautiful resume that gets her a job on a huge Madison Avenue pharmaceutical makeup company, where she has to pretend she went to Harvard and pretend she can do crew
and speak Mandarin
and basically just rampage around in high heels and be very, very nervous and fretful. I loved the first half of this, and I thought the second half gets completely insane in a way that I did not appreciate.
It does take a very strange turn into the melodramatic, which was not at all in conjunction with the first half of the film. It gets very weird. It's like they decided we need to add some family drama, so let's put this heaviness to it. I loathed this film. I thought it was absolutely it was such a transparent star vanity piece with Jennifer Lopez trying to reestablish her credentials as a comedian after she's done action, after she's been a singer, and now let's make her marketable again as a comedian. I did not care for it. I thought it was extremely transparent and very, very shallow. No. I didn't buy it for a second.
Look, I love this movie. I love this movie every time I've seen it. I love this movie every time she's made
versions.
And every version. What can you do? It is what it is. And the thing of it is, she is really good at it. She looks fantastic.
I didn't think she even... Well,
I'm sorry. She just looks fantastic. I mean, as like Jenny from the Block walking around in her jeans and talking with stuff with Leah Remini, who's her best friend. friend in the movie, and they're talking smack, and it's all, she's great. And then she puts on that power dress and that power shoot and those heels, and it's like, even better. And it's just, this is great and better. She's funny. The movie is so dumb. But again, I love these movies when Meg Ryan made them. I love these movies when Marissa Tomei made them. I love them for the 25 years that Jennifer Lopez has been making them. I'm in.
But this is just a rehashing of, you know, of all of those. This is Pretty Woman meets Mrs. Doubtfire, basically, and not nearly as good as either one of those. It's you've seen all these tropes before.
I know, but we haven't seen those two movies in a long time. Yeah. It's been a long time since A Pretty Woman and a Mrs. Doubtfire.
Second act, romantic comedy starring Jennifer Lopez, Peter Siegel, the director, rated PG-13. It's open right now in wide release. The South Korean drama Swing Kids is unrated, Tim.
Yeah. This is a really weird little movie, but it is about an interesting thing. During the Korean War, there was this gigantic prisoner of war camp that the Americans were overseeing with all these Koreans. Many of the Korean soldiers who were all originally from the North wanted to defect. And did not want to, you know, operate under our dear leader anymore. So they formed these two groups of Korean soldiers inside this one prisoner of war camp, and these groups of soldiers went to war with each other. The Americans are like, what the heck is going on with this? It's completely insane. And then there's this weird sort of swing dance theme that goes through the movie too, and that's when I'm like, I don't know what that's about, but the history of this camp, that's actually true. It's an actual, it actually happened, and you know, I wish somebody would have made a better movie about it and left the swing dancing out.
So you didn't like the sort of genre merges here.
No, made no sense whatsoever.
Swing Kids, South Korean film. It's written and directed by Yong Chol Kang. It's unrated, and you can see it in Koreatown at the CGV Cinemas Los Angeles, as well as the CGV Cinemas in Buena Park. It's open now. Between Worlds, a mystery thriller starring Nicolas Cage, written and directed by Maria Pulera. Lael, which Nicolas Cage is it?
I'm sorry. Who does Nicolas Cage owe money to that he had to that he had to take this movie? This movie is disgusting. It's so dreadful. Okay, he plays a drifter, a truck driver who is in a relationship with Franca Potente. Her daughter is in a car crash and becomes comatose. And when she comes out of the coma, she is inhabited by the spirit of Nicolas Cage's dead ex-wife, who he then begins a relationship with, the daughter of Franca Potente. So he's with Potente and he's with the daughter at the same time. And it's so gross. You actually feel dirty from watching the film. Cage has a bad weave, a bad attitude, and he clearly doesn't even want to be in this film. It's notable also perhaps for the appearance of Hopper Penn, Sean Penn, and Robin Wright's son, who's making his acting appearance. And it, I don't know, this one's going to go into the can of Nicolas Cage movies that we don't want to see. It's too bad, by the way, because there was the early Nick Cage where he was crazy and wild and we couldn't get enough of him. And then there was the sort of serious mid-period Nick Cage with Leaving Las Vegas and some other, you know, really Face Off, for example, even Con Air, even The Rock, even those Michael Bay movies, which were fun and great to see. And now we have sort of latter day Nicolas Cage where it's like he's a caricature of
himself. How does he become the go-to guy, though, for these kinds of films? It seems like there's sort of this subgenre of present-day Cage films.
Because Nick Cage is absolutely bankable at a certain price of film. And if you put Nick Cage in a film and pay him his fee, that film is going to make a certain amount of money in international markets around the world. They know that these films aren't going to play here in the United States. But it doesn't make any difference because those films make money overseas.
They're like the kind of films you'd see sold in the marketplace at the Cannes Film Festival that you won't see on screen.
Behind the curtain.
Yeah, exactly, pretty much. But, oh, boy, what a bummer.
All right, Nicolas Cage stars in Between Worlds. Maria Pulera, the writer-director, rated R. And it's open right now at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. We have several more films to talk about with our critics. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Wonderful to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This is a very big week for films. That's why we've had three critics, so many movies to see, and been a pleasure to have with us Leo Lowenstein, Amy Nicholson, and Tim Cogshell. I'm going to be off from Film Week next week and then back with you at the start of 2019 with our Film Week. Then I also want to remind you that our next Film Week Academy Awards preview is coming up fast. The Oscars are somewhat earlier this year, so our preview is earlier. Sunday afternoon, February 17th, we're back at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. Tickets are now on sale. They're reserved seats. I look forward to seeing you there for the event. Visit kpecc.org/in-person Sunday, February 17th, 1 in the afternoon, Theater at Ace Hotel. Sold out last year, and we want to see you there again at the Ace for what's going to be a terrific program. All of our critics there on stage, clips of all the films, always a very special event. Well, opening this week, American Renegades, starring J.K. Simmons, Sullivan Stapledon, and Charlie Bewley. Stephen Quayle is the director, Richard Wenk, and Luc Besson are the screenwriters. Tim?
Luc Besson being the pivotal name there. This is from the Luc Besson School of, if I ever meet you, I'll let you make a movie. He does this. All of these guys, you know, they sort of go to his film school or work with him on his movies in one capacity or another, sometimes stunt guys, sometimes special effect guys. And, you know, they write some goofy movie, and Luke, just can't say no. So he lets them make these big, insane movies. This one, it's set in Europe during wartime. You have these Navy SEALs. It opens with this absolutely insane tank battle. It's just.
That sounds expensive to put on film.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, you know, Luc Besson is rich, so he can blow stuff up. It's this crazy tank battle, and you know, it's wild and it's crazy. It's testosterone driven, all that sort of dialogue. Eventually, we get into this movie that sort of becomes like a World War II heist movie. There's some gold that was stolen by the Nazis from the French 60 years ago. It's buried at the bottom of this lake, which covered this town in a flood 50 years ago. This beautiful, beautiful Croatian girl talks one of these Navy SEALs into helping her dive and steal that gold to bring it back because she wants to help her people. And I'm like, first of all, you're an idiot if you think that's what's going to actually, but whatever, that's what they do. And the whole movie becomes about them going behind enemy lines, doing this dive, stealing this gold, and getting out of there alive. It's kind of exciting. It's kind of a mishmash of 150 little movies that you've seen before, Navy SEALs and all that kind of stuff. But mostly it is just big and loud and noisy and everything blows up at least once.
And J.K. Simmons, how's he doing this?
He's playing. You remember Arlie Ermey in Full Metal Jacket, that Arlie Ermey thing?
Yeah.
Where he's just looking at everybody screaming. Every word of dialogue is screamed. Doesn't speak. I don't know. Just all of it. Just screaming, screaming, screaming all the time. It's funny. But, you know, it's not really acting.
Is this aimed at the international market?
Because
having virtually no release here, it was very small.
It really is. And again, it's the thing that I was talking about before. We've come back around to a moment where the markets have been so fragmentized that you can make a movie. Some of the actors in this movie are famous in Belgium. They are. And you put the right people in this movie, and this movie will have a life all around the world in little markets. It's not the American market that you have to do anymore.
American Renegades is the title of the film, starring J.K. Simmons. Stephen Quayle is the director. It's rated PG-13, and it is showing in Los Angeles at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset in Hollywood. It's there right now.
If I were a rich man, yabba-dibba-dibba-dibba-dibba.
The 11th annual Christmas Eve sing-along of the Lemley Theaters for Fiddler on the Roof, the 1971 favorite, starring Topol, Norman Jewison, the director. Tim, we want to mention that it's been now going more than a decade, a chance for Angelinos to come out on Christmas Eve and sing along with the film.
I did it once about 8 years ago.
How was that?
It's a lot of fun. It's kind of like the Rocky Horror Picture Show things that sort of happen, only with a lot of middle-aged people.
Are you telling me people are dressing up?
They all dress up, but they know every word of this music. And like that song there.
Yeah.
I got to tell you, when I was a little kid, I would wander around, my brothers and I, and we would sing that.
Did you move like Topol?
Move like Topol. And my dad would be like, where did that come from? And what's going on there? Watch Fiddler on the Roof.
Fiddler on the Roof, once again, just want to alert you, the 11th annual Christmas Eve sing-along at most of the Lemley Theaters in the greater Los Angeles area. Check your local listings. The film rated G, of course. Did want to ask this group of Film Week critics about the L.A. Film Critic Association choices for best films, performances, writing and directing of 2018. Roma is the best picture of the year. Burning is the runner-up. Amy, your thoughts about your colleagues' choices here?
Yeah, it was a great time to be in that room. I mean, we awarded the slate of foreign films this year is just absolutely incredible. And so that was the thing we were just talking about nonstop. Everything was so great. Burning is fantastic. Cold War was a film we were talking about a lot in the room. Everything is amazing. What excites me the most right now about 1999, or about sorry, what did I was going to say that 2018 reminds me of 1999, where I'm looking around at this landscape of new young talents, actors who are on their second or third film, directors on their second or third film, that moment where everybody is breaking out big. I feel like we're about to see this changeover into the people who are going to define the next 15 years of film, and that's what right now feels like to me.
So you feel like we're right on the cusp of this fertile great filmmaking to come.
That's exactly what I see. People like Boots Riley coming up, movies like Blindspotting. It's really exciting.
What's funny is that exact same thing happened in 1989 to 1990. It was this moment. One False Move, Billy Bob Thornton film, came out. These little movies that just swept up out of nowhere with these directors. Julie Dadd, Daughters of the Dust. We're having another little moment like that. So I don't know whether it's a decadal thing.
It's a decadal thing. Because we get to say decadal.
Yeah. Right. Barry Jenkins has just become my favorite filmmaker in the course of, you know, two films, these two beautiful films.
Ones you're talking about?
If Beale Street Could Talk and Moonlight.
And Moonlight, yeah.
What I loved about our picks is that even if you go a notch down, the things that we actually didn't choose, so many of them were still populated with men and people of color, performances, writers and directors. So films like BlacKkKlansman and If Beale Street Could Talk and Black Panther and Boots Riley's movie.
I loved Leave No Trace. I know Deborah Granick isn't a newcomer, but gifted director.
Yeah. Well, and we gave her our new generation. Did we not?
You gave her best director for Leave No Trace.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so we awarded plenty of women, people of color. It was actually one of our most diverse slates of all time. And I felt really good about the choices that we made as a group.
Well, and what was so striking is I don't think any of us talked about it until it was over. And we sort of looked around the room like, did that just happen? Mm. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So there wasn't a conscious effort to diversify the honorees.
The best films won.
Yeah. All right. Again, Best Picture chosen by the L.A. Film Critic Association 44th Annual Award. Roma for Best Picture. Deborah Granick for Leave No Trace Best Director. Best Acting Performances, Ethan Hawke for First Reformed and Olivia Colman for The Favorite. And all kinds of other outstanding honors, including Nicholas Britell for If Beale Street Could Talk. You can hear John Horn's interview with Britell, as well as Britell playing his music on our Film Week page. We link to that, kpecc.org. For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. We wish you a very happy holiday weekend. I'm going to be off next Friday with Film Week, and I will return on the first Friday of 2019. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful weekend.